You're listening to KGOO News Juno. The following is a broadcast of Mudrooms, Juno's live storytelling event. The 8 personal stories you are about to hear were told on May 13th at the Northern Light United Church. The theme for the evening was Poop, Parasites, and Pests. Music was performed by Travis Croteau.
His name is Aaron Cook. Last spring, 4 boats and about a dozen crew set a course for Taku Harbor, located approximately 20 miles south of Juneau. Their mission? A bachelor party in the great outdoors. Little did the groom-to-be know he had a rendezvous with destiny in an outhouse.
So Juneau is quite a small town, and I know a lot of you are going to probably be able to identify the groom, but just for some semblance of anonymity, I'm going to refer to him in this story as Mr. E. So we went out for this bachelor party, and it was the location we picked was the Tiger Olson Cabin. The Tiger Olson Cabin is a publicly available rentable cabin that you can get through the state of Alaska. And this bachelor party was kind of stereotypical in a lot of ways. We had a lot of cans of beer. We had a lot of bottles of beer. We had a lot of kegs of beer. And we had a lot of bottles of whiskey, too. A real big hit that was at the bachelor party was provided by Zach, which was a spud gun. Now, a spud gun is basically a PVC cannon that fires potatoes really fast. And the one Zach built was quite powerful. It packed a wallop. It was throwing like 1-pound potatoes a couple hundred yards. And we were having a lot of fun with this thing, launching it and sending potatoes up out into Taku Harbor and watching them splash. Now, unfortunately, Mr. E got a hold of the spud gun, and his goal was terrorism, and he ended up launching potatoes at Myron and myself, and we were down on the docks about 100 yards away, and he also launched a couple potatoes at Brian in his sailboat when he was rolling in to the dock there, and Brian had a big sail and wasn't very happy about that at all. So we also had one female that was at the bachelor party. She was naked. She was also inflatable. But she ended up getting partially melted in the campfire. Somehow, like early the next morning, she was strung up swinging in the mast of Saunders' yacht on the flagpole there. Also brought there was, surprise, it's a bachelor party, a large plastic African-American male member. It also ended up partially melted in the campfire. But Mr. E also, for some reason, he loved that thing. He was running around and coming up behind people and sticking them in the ear and face and stuff like that. There's a little side story on that, I guess. I heard, now, I didn't find out this firsthand, but apparently that object we were talking about turned up a couple days later at the wedding reception. Fast forward to the next morning. And so the next morning, we woke up, and we were extremely hungover. We were pretty sluggish, and our heads were down, and we were starting to gather around the smoldering remnants of the campfire there, and we had like a Coleman stove with some bacon and eggs and a pot of coffee. And I just happened to catch some movement out of the corner of my eye. And I turned and looked, and in a T-shirt, shorts, and flip-flops, it was Mr. E sneaking his way to the outhouse. And I knew in that moment exactly what I was going to do. A light bulb went off. So I quickly turned back so he didn't notice that I had spotted him. I let him go into the outhouse, door closed. And then I turned to the rest of the crew that was gathered around and I said, "Hey guys, Mr. E's just gone into the crapper. And the spud gun is right over there." Once I said that, everyone jumped into action. The hangover's gone. Everyone was pretty much on the same page on this one, and they knew exactly what had to be done. They were on a mission. So Zach bolted into the cabin to go grab his GoPro. The rest of the crew mobilized and somehow transformed into this elite crack army howitzer artillery team. And Pat grabbed the spud gun and Chris grabbed the potato spud ammo. And I think it was Neil or someone grabbed the spray fuel for it. And they had that thing locked and loaded in probably 10 seconds. Pat grabbed the spud gun and moved into firing position about 15 yards from the outhouse. The rest of us followed to witness the festivities. He took the spud gun, took aim at the front of the outhouse door, and fired. To say that that spud, when it hit that door, became mashed potatoes would be a little bit of an understatement. It was more like a starchy mist that spread out. And there was mist and spray going up into the fir trees and such. The most glorious part about the whole impact was not the visual, it was the sound. And now, I know some of you probably, when you were visualizing this outhouse, might have pictured a wooden outhouse. This was one of those turquoise plastic outhouses like you'd see at the porta potties around town. And there was something magical about that plastic because it really just generated this resonating, loud, amplifying sound when that potato hit it. It kind of sounded like a car crash, and my ears, I was 15 yards away, and my ears were ringing. I kind of felt bad for Mr. E. Not really. So about 10 seconds elapsed after the impact, and there was dead silence. There wasn't screaming, yelling, cussing, crying, whimpering. It was just quiet. Finally, he comes out, and he just was completely expressionless. I think in World War I, they'd call this shell shock. He stood there for a few seconds with his audience watching him, and he spoke. And the only words he could mutter were, "Wow, that was loud." After that, we didn't have any problems with Mr. E. He was pretty well behaved. Just the disclaimer, there was no damage done to the outhouse, state cat property. And as for Zach and the GoPro, unfortunately, he didn't get in there in time to get it fired up and get the shot off. Instead of the video being shared with your Facebook friends, it ended up, you end up getting a mudroom story tonight. Thanks.
Todd Mace moved from Houston to Seattle in 2003, where he lived for about 8 years. After a friend put a bug in his ear about working summers in Southeast Alaska, he pushed further north and ended up in Juneau. This past July, he married his wife, Melissa, and they live happily together with their dog, Bo. They co-own Pixel and Plume Design Co., doing graphic and web design in addition to their day jobs. Todd enjoys collecting records, lowbrow art, and a wide variety of bad movies. You can hear him host the Alaskan Scorcher radio show every Tuesday night from 8 to 10 on 100.7 KXLL. Let's welcome Todd.
Hello, and I just want to say that being the number two speaker is extremely appropriate, so it was very fitting. In 2004, I was living in Seattle, and I was 24, and that year I moved into an apartment by myself for the very first time, you know, no family, no roommates, just me, and I was honestly a complete slob. I spent a lot of my time besides working. I was, you know, just going to bars, partying, going to concerts. In between all that and the hangovers, I neglected my apartment quite a bit. And the apartment itself was pretty old. It was built in the 20s or the 30s. It was three stories. I lived up top. And I didn't spend a lot of money on even, like, basic necessities for this place. At one point, though, I did go to Costco, as most people do, and I bought the requisite giant pack of toilet paper. And the giant pack of paper towels. As time went on, you know, I ran out of the toilet paper, and I then moved on to the paper towels. I don't know how long that went on for, but in the end, it was definitely too long. Part of my ritual of being on the toilet was just having the roll of paper towels and taking a sheet off and making little squares out of it, and I'd stack them up next to the toilet, and that's what I would use to wipe myself for. Again, too long. Fast forward to a Saturday, and I have brunch plans that morning. Reluctantly pull myself out of bed. Just enough time to make it to brunch. And I go to the bathroom, sit down on the toilet, and everything's going fine. I give myself a courtesy flush. Then I use some paper towels, as I have been describing. Flush the paper towels, and it was almost instantaneous that I knew something was wrong. Now, remember, I was on the top floor. You know, it was an old building, so you could hear the water go down. As soon as it went down, I heard this bellowing reverb, I guess you could say, reverb. And it's a sound that I can't really imitate, but it definitely wasn't human. It was the building, and it was really mad. So, and I'm still sitting down, and I hear the sound, and I'm like, oh, no. And then I hear the pipes clanging, clang, 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 getting higher and higher and higher. And it's obviously the unmistakable sound of the water rushing back up, and it has one destination, and the toilet actually started to shake a little bit. And it wasn't quite like out of like the Money Pit with Tom Hanks, if you know what I'm talking about, but... So I get up in one motion, I like pull my pants up, grab a towel from that was hanging on the door. I need a shield or something, I don't know. And so I turn back to the toilet, and as I turn around, there is just this giant mushroom cloud of like brown water coming up out of the toilet. And it wasn't like up to the ceiling or anything, but it definitely went up to the top of the tank, which is, you know, about that high. It didn't go straight up, it was coming straight at me. So I naturally, like, jump back with my towel, you know, and it just creates this wave that just crashes, like, and it's a tiny bathroom, too. I mean, there's nowhere to go. The door's shut. I just kind of, like, step back, and, you know, like, much like a wave comes at you, it then receded backwards, and the floor was kind of slanted, by the way. So it crashes back up against the wall. It was a lot of water. And so in my head, in that moment, I reacted well enough, I guess. I was like, well, I know I can't sop it up with this towel, but I can at least create like a little dam, right? So it won't keep coming back at me. And so I just jump down and I just go for it, right? And I get down on my hands and knees and I'm like putting the towel down. And then that's when I realize I'm like, you know, there was a lot more water that came out than what is currently on the floor. And as I'm down close to the bottom of the toilet, that's when I hear another unmistakable sound, and it's basically a waterfall. I mentioned it's an old building. I'm on the top floor. And that's when I noticed that the toilet wasn't completely sealed to the floor, so the water was going underneath it and into my neighbor's bathroom. At that point, that's when I hear a lot of, like, bad words being cursed by my neighbor. And then I hear the other sound of the dun-dun-dun-dun, him running up the stairs. And, like, down the hallway, and the footsteps are getting closer, and then they're banging on my door. And he's like, all I hear is, like, hey, man, there's raw sewage coming down from my ceiling. So I open the door. He's just like, then all of a sudden, he's, like, super nice, which was weird. He's like, hey, man, my name's Mike. And there's, like coming from the ceiling. Like, I don't know what's going on. And I'm like, dude, I don't know. Like, the toilet exploded. It's always best to play dumb in these types of situations. And he's like, well, I'm calling the landlord. And in my head, I'm like, damn it. And so I'm like, yeah, I'll do that. I shut the door, and I'm like, great, now the landlord's coming. So I run back to the bathroom to assess, like, the damage. And I see that the toilet's still clogged. But surprisingly, like, there was no paper or anything. It was just all just water, thankfully. So I'm like, well, I don't want the landlord to find the toilet clogged. I was like, the corner store, they have to have a plunger, right? Because I didn't have one. So I grab my bike, I run downstairs, jump on the bike, right over the store. And the whole time, I'm like, I'm going to get evicted. Like, this is terrible. Like, I'm supposed to be at brunch. You know, it's like, I want a mimosa. This is terrible. I just basically took a crap on my neighbor, you know. So I get back home, and I run upstairs, put the bike away, and I plunge it, and it goes away. And it was almost just a couple of minutes later, there's another knock at the door, and it's, you know, the landlord. And I just, like, pause before I open it, and I'm like, oh, he's going to be so mad. I wasn't, like, paying rent on time. You know, I was, like, super loud when I was there, and I was, like, the least ideal neighbor and tenant. So I open the door. And I'll never forget, I can't remember his name, but I'll never forget what he was wearing, because it was the most ridiculous outfit. He had a white undershirt on that was V-neck, and it was tucked into a pair of gray sweatpants, and then he had a pair of Birkenstocks on, and in one hand, he had a bottle of 409 and a roll of paper towels in the other hand, and he just looked like the world's worst superhero. I mean, like, in my head, I'm like, you should have brought a hazmat suit, because this is just not going to cut it. So I open the door, and I see him, and I don't even say anything. I just kind of turn, and just he knows where the bathroom is, so he just starts meandering over there. And he kind of looks in, and he doesn't do anything. He's just silent for, like, 30 seconds. And so he turns, and he looks at me, and just, like, straight in the eyes, he's like, so what did you do? Did you take a big woo? I had never heard that term before. But in that moment, I felt like a 5-year-old kid, you know. He's like, one of my favorite parts is he sees the plunger. He's like, well, at least you have a plunger. And in my head, I'm like, yes, like, you know, it's totally worth going to the store and buying that plunger. And then he leaves. I'm just still standing there in awe, and I look at the time, and I'm like, oh, I'm late for brunch. And then so I get in the shower, get on my bike, and I ride downtown to Belltown to meet my friends, and I was about half an hour late. The only thing they asked was, like, so what took you so long? And I was like, you know, my landlord showed up, and I had to talk to him for, like, 20 minutes, and he just kept going on and on and on and on. And then I had brunch, and it was just a regular Saturday after that. So thank you for listening to my tale about pooping on my neighbor.
So our next speaker is Travis Smith. He is a local business owner who moved to Juneau in 1987. He graduated before there were two high schools or an ice rink, but remembers when the glacier was in front of the waterfall. Travis has been pooping all over the planet for 35 years, most of the time right here in southeast Alaska. Recently in Mexico, far away as Ethiopia, as low as the water on a low tide, and as high as 35,000 feet. Everyone has their story, but not everyone's had GRD. Please welcome Travis.
I awoke to the call of prayer. I was in Indonesia, and it was 2009. I was in a hut on stilts in a pond with floor-to-ceiling windows looking out to see the sunlight streaming through the trees, and as the mist was rising over blossoming lotus flowers, there were koi swimming in the water. I could see them from where I sat. The water was so clear, and the fish were so large, and there was the song and the sound of birds, and then there was the sound of mosquitoes. And I look up above my bed, and I see that the wall is covered in large blood-filled mosquitoes that have been feasting on me all night long. And I remember thinking that they had told me there were mosquitoes here. I didn't need to worry. We didn't have any malarial problems in the area. There's no dengue fever, none of these pesky little mosquito-borne parasites to worry about. So flash forward about 12 days, 12 nights later, I'm waking up in a hotel in Medan near the end of the trip. I've got 4 hours before I begin a journey back to Alaska that goes something like this. Medan to Kuala Lumpur to Singapore for a night and a day and a night and a 4 a.m. flight to Hong Kong, then L.A., then Chicago, then Seattle, then Juneau. Don't ask about the Chicago part. It's miles. You win some, you lose some. Here I am. I'm waking up. I feel like I have had just too many gin and tonics, which has been a regular occurrence on the trip. So nothing out of the ordinary, nothing at breakfast, and a nice cup of coffee is not going to fix. So we go to breakfast. I decline to have the walk around the city afterwards because that coffee's just not sitting so good. And I'm going to spend some time alone in the bathroom before we begin the flights back. So I got to use a bidet for the first time in this nice shiny hotel room. I was no longer cared that I was potentially worried about how they operated. It didn't matter anymore. You had to use what was there. I spent some more alone time in the hotel lobby bathroom before getting on the cab ride to the airport. Again, in the downstairs bathroom at the airport, and the upstairs bathroom at the airport before boarding the flight. It was a short flight to Kuala Lumpur, thank God, because I had to find two more bathrooms in that airport when I got there. The flight to Singapore was kind of short as well. Again, time in the bathroom alone to think about the malaria that I'm sure is now infecting my blood, because why else would I be getting sick? Thank you, Google, for letting me look up, you know, malarial infestation dates, and it's 10 to 14 days. You can see the first signs, and I am sure that that is what I'm leaving everywhere, is little pieces of malarial feces and bathroom trees all over Indonesia right now. So I get to Singapore, and I'm supposed to spend a night there, and then I had a day to go shopping and to see the sights, and then an early 4 a.m. flight out. And the first thing I thought was, well, I need to eat something. I haven't eaten anything since breakfast. That didn't go so well. I'm just going to get a dinner. I'm going to go to bed. I'm going to wake up. I'm going to be a new man. It's going to be great. Dinner was a bad decision. I ate dinner. I had about 18 minutes to get back to my hotel room before all hell broke loose. My body was rejecting every single thing that had been put in it out of any possible area that could reject any form of liquid. And for 8 hours, I wished I was dead. But one end or the other scenario just over and over again, and you couldn't even hold down water after a while. And after a while, there was nothing coming out. And I was like, well, it has to end, right? This feeling has to end at some point, and it just doesn't end. I eventually decide that the solution is no input, no output. I will eat and drink nothing. I only have 40 hours. People can survive for 40 hours without eating or drinking anything. It happens to people, right? I still think I'm going to make it around Chinatown for my day of trying to gather up trinkets and things to bring home. And I learned two things. They don't place bathrooms in obvious places in Chinatown in Singapore. And sitting outside at the table is there to sell you toilet paper. You don't have it inside. So once you've gone inside, you missed your opportunity to get that toilet paper. Other than barely finding bathrooms when I really needed them and then deciding that shopping wasn't necessary anymore, I went back to the hotel and decided, that's it. I'm going to stay here and use this bathroom where I know where everything is, and I can lay down immediately afterwards on the cold tile floor and not have to worry about what my head's in. So I wake up at 3 in the morning to take my flight, long flights, and I get to the airport, and they immediately tell me that the flight's been canceled for 13 hours because of a jet crash on the runway in Hong Kong. And I'm like, great, that's... could have been my plane. Instead, I'm stuck in the Singapore airport for 13 hours. Nobody ever has a layover. Great airport. There's bathrooms everywhere. They're just all up and down, all of the huge concourse. And eventually, I found my way to a medical station, had a really nice conversation with someone about, why can't we just do a blood test now? I'm pretty sure I've got malaria. What can you give me for it? And he explained that it didn't work like that. He couldn't just diagnose malaria in the room, but he could provide me with some charcoal activated tablets and some stuff that would basically make my stomach stop working, so stop happening. If I ever saw that guy again, I would kiss him. It all worked just like that. My stomach just turned into a rock. The charcoal turned into a nice charcoal blanket. Nothing went, and I didn't eat anything. I didn't drink anything, and nothing came out. And so that was how I spent the 8-hour flight to Hong Kong and a couple hours there, and then, 12 or 13 hours to L.A., and then 5 hours to Chicago, and 4 hours back to Seattle, and then the 2 hours to Juneau to make it to my doctor to explain to him that I have malaria. I know I have malaria. He's like, no, you don't have malaria. Your bones would feel like they were inside your body if you had malaria. You would be puking and crapping everywhere, yes, but you don't have the bone-shattering feeling. You probably just have Giardia. And I'm thinking to myself, there was that day on the way on where we stopped and swam in the lake and then drank ice cubes in it, followed by eating with our hands at the Balinese restaurant. These were the things that led to this problem of Giardia.
Our next speaker is Jordan Watson. Jordan became a marine biologist so that he could travel the world and dive in amazing places. That plan worked pretty well, sending him on a whirlwind of adventures for most of a decade, from diving for krill beneath the Antarctic sea ice to milking sea lions off of California. Marine biology eventually evolved, however, if you believe in evolution, into him standing at a computer all day writing computer code about fish. After grad school, he took a break from building computer models of fish, and instead, he spent the summer modeling HIV treatment in East Africa, which is where today's poop story will take us.
So when I finished my master's in fisheries, I somehow managed to get a job working for the Clinton Foundation doing HIV/AIDS work. And I will, for the record, state that I did not take donations from multinational corporations nor foreign governments while I was there. So if I ever run for anything, you guys. So with the Clinton Foundation, they kind of bounce you all over the place, but I started out in Ethiopia. When I got to Ethiopia, you ask the typical questions of your coworkers, like, is it safe to walk around at night? How do you do this? How do you do that? Do you have to pay for toilet paper? Stuff like that. Everybody, all my coworkers, there were about a dozen expats and then a whole cadre of local Ethiopian workers that worked with us, and nobody had ever had problems. Nobody had muggings or break-ins or anything like that, so you really didn't worry too much about it. And all of the foreign staff lived in one of two houses. The houses were a little over a mile apart, and one house had internet and one didn't. So, of course, everybody wanted to be in the internet house. New guy was not. Sunday morning, I got up and I was going to wander over. It was actually the end of my first week in Ethiopia. And so I was going to head over and do email and Skype and stuff with home. And even though everybody said it was safe, I still instinctively would split out my money. So you would have like your mugging pocket, right? So you'd have a bunch of small bills in one pocket and then you'd have your wad in the other pocket. So you'd have something to give them. Other than that, I didn't really worry about it. And I started to head over to the other house in the morning. And you walk down a main strip for a while and then kind of down a side road for a little ways, maybe a couple hundred yards. And so I turned down this little road, and it's Sunday morning. Nobody's out, except for this one guy who, for the sake of the story, I'll nickname him Tripod. So Tripod is naked, really tall. So for me, he's maybe 6'6", something like that. And his whole front side's covered in blood, which is a little weird. He and I didn't really make eye contact or anything. He was kind of on his side of the road, and I was on mine, and so I'm just kind of watching him out of the corner of my eyes. I'm walking past, and he didn't really even seem to acknowledge me. So I just keep going, and I noticed right as I'm about to pass him that he squats down, and he's got a bag in his hand, like a little brown paper bag type of thing, and he poops onto the bag, and I was like, huh. Well, that's cool. He's going to, like, pick that up afterwards and deposit in the trash receptacle. Oh, that's awesome. So I kept walking past him, and I was almost to the house. So the house is here in little expat land, or, you know, big, huge block walls, stainless steel rods on the top, and then sprinkled with broken glass for good measure. So you have to be let in. So you would knock, and there was a guard 24/7 who would let you in. And I'm so close to the door, so close. And I hear from behind me, I hear, brrr. You might think it's cold because if you're walking around naked, but Burr is also the name of money in Ethiopia. So he's asking me for money, and I turn around, and here he is. He's got just his birthday suit raised out, and he's got a rock in one hand, and he's got his bag of, like, drippy, gooey, gnarly love in the other hand. And they're both, like, rocked back and ready to throw. And I'm, like, doing this quick – I do math, so I'm, like, sitting here, like, okay, he throws the rock first – then I have an open wound, and then the poop comes into the wound. We don't want that. So what about the poop? And then I realize he's not actually giving me a choice anyway, so it doesn't matter what I think is the best scenario. So I start scrambling, and I, of course, reach into the wrong pocket, and I pull out the bills, and I throw him, like, a whole bunch of money in small bills, which kind of fly all over, and he bends down and puts the rock down and starts to pick everything up. Meanwhile, I run over, and I start pounding on the door. I'm like, let me in, let me in, open the door. Finally, the guard opens the door, and as soon as I hear the bolt unslide, I just slam into the door with my shoulder and then slam the door shut. And he realizes all of a sudden, like, oh, man, I thought you just wanted to check your email really bad. He sees the look on my face, like, whoa, something's actually wrong. And I was like, oh, it's okay, it's okay. He's like, what happened? I was like, oh, there's this guy, he's naked, blood, poop, ah, there's a rock. And he, you know, that, ah, it's fine, it doesn't matter. And he's like, no, 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 no. And this is my job. And so he, like, there's always this baseball bat behind the door. And I was like, no, don't open the door. He slides the bolt back and he opens it up. And I'm like, and off in the distance, you see like a gazelle, just like these super long legs running down the road. This guy with the rock and the poop raised and running, which just looks dangerous for one. But also, like, I'm not sure where the money was. I'm not sure where he was, like, holding it or anything. But so he closes the door, and I'm just like, okay, all right, we're good, we're good. Let's just leave it at that. We're solid. It's Sunday morning. And so all this commotion woke the country director up, who lives in this house. And he comes down and he's like, what's going on? What's going on? I was like, oh. And the guard's like, oh, Jordan mugged poop by poop. And Peter looks at me and he's like, pretty sure I missed something in the translation here. So do you want to go ahead and tell me what happened? And I was like, no, that was pretty much, yeah, that's pretty straight. I was like, there's this really tall guy covered in blood. And he had poop in a hand and then a rock, and he was going to, you know, so I gave him some money. Peter was irate. He's like, no, 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 this is ridiculous. We can't have this happening. We don't want him to think that we're, like, you know, that they can just hang out here. And I was like, God, dude, just leave it. He's like, no, 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 we got to go after him. No, we're not going after him. No, we got to go. Oh, my God. So we get in the car and we drive like a block. I'm like, oh, we don't know where he went. And the driver rolls down the window and in Amharic. I'm not sure how it translates exactly, but he asked some passersby, hey, did you see a naked bloody guy running down the road with some poop? Maybe a rock and a whole bunch of bills? And they're like, yep. He went that way. So we get to another intersection. Hey, have you guys been checking? Yep. He went that way. Like, all you got to do at this point is ask, and it's just a strange scene. So we finally find him, and I was like, okay, great, Peter, we found him. Now let's go home. Like a new windshield for the fancy Land Cruiser in Ethiopia is probably like, I don't know how much, a lot more than I gave him. Let's just go home. So I finally eventually talk him into going back to the house. And he's like, oh, fine. He sulks back to the house. And I finally got to the computer, and I opened up the computer, and I sent my parents my first email since I'd been in Ethiopia. And I was like, pretty uneventful first week so far. Getting access to the internet can be a little but other than that, it's all good.
You're listening to a recording of Mudrooms, Juno's live storytelling event on KTOO News Juno. These stories are recorded on May 13th, 2015 at the Northern Light United Church. The theme for the evening was Poop, Parasites, and Pests. Curious? Visit mudrooms.org. He's 18 years old. His name is Jacob Riddle. He's a senior at Yakus, and his bio tonight is he's dashingly handsome and rugged. All right. Please welcome Jacob Riddle.
All right. So as she told you, I'm Jacob Riddle. I am a high school. I go to Yakutsk, Dakahiti. This story kind of revolves almost around my brother. It's actually a few people that were in the story are here with us tonight. About five rows down is my mother and my sister right there. If everyone will please just direct all of your undivided attention straight to them. My brother joined the Air Force around 2006 or 2007. He graduated in 2005, so I was just about in some middle school grade. He'd been gone for a while, you know, with boot camp and being shipped all over here and there, and finally he kind of settled down in Tucson, Arizona, so we figured, why don't we spend a nice warm Christmas, you know, down in Tucson instead of Montana. So we were taking a road trip down there, and the story takes place in Nevada. So for many of you who have been to Nevada, it is a barren wasteland with Las Vegas just kind of in there. We're driving and going through the desert. Nothing but desert. I had to use the bathroom. I mean, and it's not like I have the pleasure of being, you know, a male. I can just pull over and take care of business on the side of the road. But this wasn't one of those times, you see. It was, I mean, you could. You could pull over and deal with it, but it's frowned upon. So I'm just hoping, you know, like usually there is construction on roads, and a lot of the times construction workers need a place to go to the bathroom, so like porta potties. But there was nothing. The one time that you're actually genuinely upset that there isn't construction on the road, and almost like the clouds part, even though there's no such thing as clouds in Nevada because it's a wasteland, is this novelty store. I'm literally about to burst, all right? I mean, and so we pull up to this novelty store, and I go inside, and I, you know, doing a little dance, like, hey, where's your guys' bathroom at? And the store clerk says, you gonna buy something? Like, yeah, my mom's gonna be coming in like 3 seconds. She'll buy something, and then we'll call it square, right? And he's like, bathroom's around back. And so I open up the door, little jingle bells, and I go up to the men's bathrooms, kind of on like the backside of this. I wouldn't so much call it a store as like a shack. There's the door, so I go and I knock on it, and I can hear someone just kind of messing around in there. I'm like, okay, now's really not the time for there to be somebody in the bathroom. And so I knock on the door, nothing here. So I knock on the door again, a little bit harder. I'm like, come on, this is an emergency. If you could just kind of hurry it up a little bit, and then still nothing. And so then I bang on the door again, a little third time. I'm like, come on, man, just pinch it off. I really got to go. And all you hear is, so this guy's not even trying to be sneaky. So I have to really evaluate my decisions or my choices here. I can wait with the possibility of crapping my pants in the middle of the desert. You can't buy pants in a novelty store. And so I'm like, well, I haven't seen anybody in about 50-something miles, so I'll go to the woman's bathroom. And so I go over there. Sure enough, there's nobody in the woman's bathroom. Coast is clear. I kind of look around. Okay, no one's watching. And I enter the woman's bathroom, and it's not all it's cracked up to be. I mean, it's just, and so I get down to business, and with the details, I mean, this is not your average, ordinary BM. This is something that they write songs about, something that you warn your children not to go out at night. I mean, this is bad. It's happened to everybody at least twice. And so I'm going about my business, and I hear the door open and jangle. I'm like, oh, it's probably my mom or my sister coming to just let me know that everything's okay. And so I didn't really think much about it, but I hear probably the footsteps of 4 or 5 people. And then I start hearing voices. Now, I'm not a linguist, so this could have been anywhere between French and, like, Japanese. But what I could decipher is that they were all female. And so I'm like, oh, no. And I'm trying to think of stuff. And then they come to the door, and then they pound on the door. I'm like, okay. All right, Jacob. This is where the ability to think on your feet becomes absolutely critical to your success. All right, this is where they separate the men from the boys in the women's bathrooms. I look at the window. It is barred, okay? Can't get through there. There's no air ducts, so I can't pull a die hard and get out through that way. I mean, the only way out is through that door. Okay, so I kind of finish up and I go to flush the toilet. What do you know? Toilet doesn't flush. Big surprise. Okay, is there a plunger? No, there isn't. Because you're at a novelty store. In Nevada. And so then back to that thinking on your feet thing. You know, you really got to be making decisions. And so I thought the most reasonable thing to do is I took a deep inhale. And with my prettiest falsetto, I said, just a minute. I was lucky enough that when I was in middle school, I could sport some pretty nice facial hair. But this wasn't one of those times where you want that. But luckily, I was very punk rock and had a nice long head of hair. And I opened the door. I'm like, excuse me. And I have to kind of make my way through the nice lady. It's like, not convincing at all. They're looking at me. They know I'm not a lady. And so I kind of make it to the corner, and then I just start booking it because I hear one of them go in there, and she just starts losing it. Who did this? What kind of person could do such a thing to a bathroom? Me. I can. And so I go through the, open the door, jingle, 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 and the store owner is like, hey, you didn't buy anything. All right, so my mom, right there, like I mentioned earlier, she's right there, she didn't buy anything. She didn't even go inside. And so I looked that storekeeper right in the eyes. And I said, no. And then I left because he was like one of those kind of like kind of guys you use sounds to describe. And so I made it back to the car and we continued our journey through the wasteland that is Nevada. Didn't run into any more novelty stores. We crossed the Hoover Dam. That was okay, I guess. But I guess the one thing that you can take from this story for yourself is just use the bathroom before you go.
Our next speaker is Zach Wilkinson. Zach was born and raised in New Mexico before moving to Guam, and he has lived in Juneau for about 8 years. Zach's story is about how poop helped him decide to go to college. Zach was recruited to tell this story at a party last year where grown-ups in togas were getting hopped up on miracle berries and maybe a little tequila. Zach also wants to thank the folks that put this mudrooms thing together, especially Amanda, for all her patience and persistence in organizing the speakers. Here's Zach.
Here, Zach, put these on. You're going to want to throw away whatever you wear today. That bog of eternal stench doesn't wash off. That's what my boss said to me on this morning I'd like to tell you about. So when I graduated from high school in 1999, I didn't want to go to college. I didn't want to learn how to use computers. I didn't want to learn how to use cell phones. I had this romantic idea that I was going to be a cowboy. So I got a job on a ranch in Hondo, New Mexico, right out of high school. And this ranch was owned by a multi-billionaire. He didn't live there. He just came around to play on the ranch basically once in a while. And he'd bring his rich buddies and his Revlon girls. And I worked for the wildlife manager there, which basically meant our job was to make sure there was stuff for this guy to shoot at. So we raised deer and we raised a ton of birds. We raised about 30,000 birds, about 10,000 pheasant, 20,000 bobwhite quail every summer. When the quail, when the birds got to be, you know, about this size, kind of adolescent, we moved them into what we called the bird barn. Now the bird barn was full of these hutches that had these hutches were made out of chicken wire, you know, chicken wire and 2x4. They had chicken wire floors on them so that they were probably 3 or 4 feet up off of the ground, so that all the poop and all of the extra bird feed and the feathers and the dander and all of the nastiness from these birds would just fall down on the ground below there. So you can imagine this environment underneath here. It's moist. There's lots of poop and, I mean, just really awful stuff. It's all sort of fermenting, and the flies would get in there and fill it with maggots, and so it kind of moved on its own. And it was just about as that's the reaction I'm looking for. Yeah, it was really, really gross. And birds, especially when you put a whole bunch of them in a small space, they tend not to survive really well. Their odds aren't so great. And they also turn to cannibalism frequently. So there was also quite a few dead birds, and the dead birds would fall down in this mess as well. And it was usually blanketed with flies. Anyway, that's probably enough of that. So we had to clean it up periodically, you know, every day or so. And one of the ways we did that was just with a big pressure washer. We'd get in there and just blow it all back. There was a big open drain in the back of this bird barn. So we'd just wash it all back there, and it'd run from the drain down into this septic tank. On this morning, our job was to clean out the septic tank at the bird barn. And we had to move it. So we dug a big trench that we were going to pump all this stuff into. And my boss, he gave me a set of his old clothes because he knew this stuff. I mean, it's really bad. It does not wash off. It wasn't a joke. And so I'm in these big sloppy clothes that don't even come close to fitting me, but I'm just trusting him, you know, because we do some pretty gross jobs at this place. So if he says it's bad, it's really bad. So we popped the lid off this thing, and the top of it has, you know, there's some foam. And then it's liquidy, and then underneath is this solid-ish, you know, just gray-green, gooey, lumpy mess. I mean, it's the most, really, like, the most awful thing you can imagine. It's and oddly enough, it didn't smell so bad, but my job was to stir it. Because we had to get all these solids up into sort of a solution so that the pump would be able to grab it all and we could get it out of there. We didn't want to have all the solids left in the bottoms. So we got this big metal rod with, like, a blade on the end of it. You know, I get it in there, and I start stirring, and that's when the smell comes. Yeah, I don't know. I've been thinking for a week or two about how to describe it, and I just can't. It is just so awful. You know, it's death and decay and fermentation and everything all mixed into one. And I'm doing my best not to let anything splash because I really don't want any of this on me. And so we get this pump set up. It's a big, you know, gas-powered, serious pump, and we get the hose down in there, hose about this big around, and then we got another hose coming out the other end to pump it all into this trench. And we get it fired up, and things are going all right, and I'm stirring, and this stuff is belching out, and the smell is really getting awful now. A few minutes into it, everything just stops. The motor stops running. The stuff stops flowing. Nothing's happening. So we take apart the pump, figure out what's going on. It's completely clogged with bones and feathers from all of these birds and all this nasty stuff. And then all the other goop is, you know, jammed up against it in there too. So we get it cleaned out, and now we're covered in this stuff, and we put it all back together. And my boss, Troy, and his partner, John, decide the solution to this problem is that, well, we'll just have Zach aim the pump. We don't need the hose, the out hose. He'll just aim the pump at the trench, and most of it will get in there, and then we're good. So there I am, you know. I'm aiming the pump, and we get it fired up, and this thing is running, and it's a powerful pump. It's pushing a lot of stuff through it, but it's like belching and burping and kind of sputtering, and it's because this stuff is not smooth. It's not liquid by any means, and so it's splashing, and it's right here. I'm hugging this big heavy gas powered pump, so it's coming on me, and ever so often a nice breeze would blow back in my face and bring this spray all over me. We got it pumped, and I threw the clothes away, and that was the day I decided I should go to college. Thank you.
Some females have stories on this subject, too, like Miss Tracy Goldsmith. Tracy grew up in the woods of Wisconsin and is a complete cheesehead despite a recent dairy sensitivity. She comes from two very large Wisconsin posses, the Goldsmiths and the Lufenbergs. And this story is dedicated to those people she is lucky enough to call family. Her story begins while she was working in Antarctica, and she likes to think of it as the time when really hit the fan in her life. Tracy Goldsmith.
Okay, so we're all familiar with that small social media website called Facebook, right? You know, the one where you can post status updates like it's beautiful and sunny in Juneau and make all those suckers who aren't here jealous. It's also a site where people can tag you in things like really unfortunate photos. And can we just agree that Throwback Thursday shouldn't include college photos? I think that's really unnecessary. Anyway, so when I was working in Antarctica, Facebook and email were kind of my links to the outside and kept me connected to my friends and family. So on a pretty regular basis, I would take my coffee and my muffin before work and sit down at a computer and check them both. So one day I am checking Facebook, and I see I have little red numbers up in the right-hand corner, and I'm excited because I'm being notified that somebody's tagged me in something. So I open it up and see that I've been tagged in a post that says, "Your family is in our thoughts and prayers." I'm like, "Don't panic, Goldsmith, just check your email." And I switch over, and I find out that my dad has landed himself in the hospital with a massive stroke. So I get on the phone right away and call the hospital so I can get his status update from my mother. And while she's trying to fill me in on the situation, I keep hearing this really distracting noise in the background. It's really hard to follow what she's saying because there's the sound that kind of sounds like Chewbacca, and it's just like, rah, rah, rah. And I'm like, "Ma, what is that sound? What's going on there?" And she's like, "Oh, that's just your dad, honey." And I was like, I should probably come home, huh, Mom?" And she goes, "Yeah, I think that's a good idea." So luckily, 3 hours later, there was a flight north out of McMurdo, and I got on it. And 36 hours later, I was next to my dad's hospital bed back in Wisconsin. And there was my dad, the strongest man in my life, in a hospital gown and looking super vulnerable. His arms that had once driven a Harley motorcycle thousands of miles across this country were covered in IVs. His voice that would say things like, "I don't think that's necessary," or "I'm finer than frog hair," was completely unintelligible. And the mouth that used to shovel in cheese curds and ice cream was now being fed via tube down the nose. So I'm home for a couple of days, and it became a concern to the doctors that since the stroke, my dad had not had a bowel movement. So they decide to give him a suppository, and I am the only one there that day. So they tell me, you know, "When things start rolling, just call us in. We'll take care of it. Should take about 30 minutes. So I sit down next to my dad, and we work on a crossword puzzle together. 20 minutes go by, and he suddenly lunges over and grabs my arm in this death grip, and his face is all clenched, and it's turning red, and he's looking panicked, and he's trying to say, "I'm gonna poop," and I'm frantically and desperately pushing the nurse's button. Because I just can't imagine seeing my dad the bed. Luckily, the nurses came in within seconds, and thank God for nurses. I got the hell out of there and let the professionals take care of my dad. Meanwhile, I go to the family waiting room and have a little breakdown and decide I gotta go home. I'd come back the next day. So I show up the next day, and my dad is excitedly trying to tell me something. So I have to hold a letter board in front of him, which is his new communication tool. So with the letter board, he has to spell out what he's trying to say so we can understand him. And so he spells out, "That was a hard P-O-O-P, poop." I was like, "It sure was, Dad." Physically for him, emotionally for me, and we both busted up laughing. So my family came up with a plan to deal with this situation, and so we decided that I would go back to Antarctica and finish my contract out while my mom took family medical leave. And when her medical leave would be finished, it's about the same time that my job in Antarctica was done, so I'd come home and replace her as caretaker for a little while. You know, I have about 8 weeks to think about this new role and, you know, our new family situation. And I have a lot of things weighing heavily on my mind, mainly like the progress that my dad's making. Like, I'm really hoping he's getting stronger and more mobile. But 8 weeks later, when I return to Wisconsin, I find him still wheelchair bound. He now wears a skate belt around his waist so we can help him stand up and keep him steady while he shuffles around. And he's still pretty nonverbal, so the letter board is pretty important. And now he has a peg tube in his stomach to keep sufficient amount of calories flowing in, which of course means those calories will be coming out. After I'm home for a few days, my mom has to return back to work, and so I'm left home alone with my dad for the first time. So my job is to get him up in the morning, which is, he's become worse than a teenager. he's kind of like, I'm old and I had a stroke. I don't have to get out of bed anymore. So I get him out of bed and I help him get dressed. And I take him into the bathroom and I help him brush his hair, brush his teeth, and I help him shave. And then I take him out to his recliner in the living room and set up his lunch, which is basically pouring his new liquid diet into a gravity bag. And then I plug that into his peg tube. About an hour and a half goes by, and then I hear those words I'm dreading to hear, which are, I gotta poop. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna be cheerful. We're gonna get through this. I help him up, take him into the bathroom. His job has become to grab this new handlebar that they've installed in their bathroom, and he can pull himself up. My job is to hold on to his gait belt while he sort of shuffles his butt around and lines it up with the toilet. I pull down his pants. Together, we both gently ease him down on the toilet, and then I leave so he can do his business. And while he's doing that, I am pacing nervously in the kitchen, trying to psych myself up for this next new job. And then I hear him call for me, at which point I return to the bathroom. He grabs the handlebar. I grab his gait belt. Together, we stand him up. I hesitate while I'm standing there looking into his big, sparkly blue eyes. And I just need reassurance again that what I'm about to do is okay. And so I say, Dad, are you sure okay with me wiping your butt? And he gives me a look that can only be translated like this. Are you a blooming idiot? I'm standing here with my pants down. I just took a dump. There's nobody else home. If I could do it myself, I would. And then his face softens, and he gives this shrug and this head nod that he does now. And he's kind of like, yes, it's okay. So I do it. I clean him up just like he used to do for me many moons ago. And he's still the strongest man in my life. We just have a new normal now. Thanks.
Our last storyteller for the evening is Timothy Miles. Timothy Miles considers himself to be very blessed with regards to life experiences. He has lived in Asia, Europe, and Africa, and has traveled extensively throughout the U.S. and the Northwest Arctic region of Alaska, from Little Diomede to Savunga, to name a few. He has cared for African elephants and big cats, herded camels in northern Kenya, worked as a wildlife biologist, photojournalist, flight medic, paratrooper, professional raft guide, and environmental activist, and a host of other experiences that continue to provide a river of stories. He feels Jimmy Buffett sums up his life best. If you ever wonder why you ride the carousel, you do it for the stories you can tell.
And I just...
He, his wife Lisa, and son Cedar have lived in Juneau since 2001. Here's Timothy.
I was a senior keeper for a wild animal park down in southern Oregon. And about, kind of like this. It's kind of, getting kind of dusky. It was warm and quiet. The park had quieted down. The animals have started to quiet down. And I was making my tour around the park just to make sure everything was set for me to go home and there wasn't any crises or anything to deal with. And as I was kind of going by the elephant area, I noticed that I was missing 7 African elephants. I knew about
crazy.
Before that, typically my routine was to go to the elephant barn and set out the meal for that night and in preparation, because they're the last to go in. They were missing. And I went into the area there, and I noticed somebody had figured out how to unhook the hot wire. I don't know. I still don't know which one did it, but they figured it out how to take it off, and my thinking was they're probably up at the barn. So I went over to the barn, and I came around the corner, and standing in the doorway was Nandi, which was one of the youngest elephants. I'm always I believe in the power of names, and Nandi isn't really a powerful name. It's kind of like, oh, don't be so Nandi. Just go do it, So obviously the other elephants got her to be the watch. And she was standing there half in and half out, looking around. And I came around and I went, Nandi. And she looked and her ears flared and she immediately turned around and went in and obviously was going, he's here, we're busted. I told you this wasn't a good idea. And I walked in and I said, what are you guys doing in here? You're not supposed to be in here. And everybody's ears are out and you hear this kind of blowing through the trunk and everybody's kind of a little agitated and stuff. And I said, you, everybody out. And so we all went outside and we lined up and I said, are you supposed to be in here? I love talking to my elephants. They were just absolutely, they're amazing. They were like overgrown kids in big, big clothes. So we had this discussion, and I said, all right, everybody in. The routine is they go into the barn, and they all have their spots where they spend, that's their spot, and their food is laid out there. And they're not to touch it until we bow. And I say, okay. So they're standing there, and then I knew I needed to take care of Tiki's foot. And so I got behind Tiki there, and I'm going, foot, 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 foot. And she finally lifts her foot up so I could take a look at it. Well, of course, I'm kind of positioned this way. And all of a sudden, I feel this rather large weight, warm, moist, yet comforting. And the fluid in it started making its way down my spine and pooled up about right here. And I was like, really? Right about that time, Tiki kind of turns and looks back at me and kind of goes, it's kind of like life, isn't it? Anyway, that was fine. And I looked over and I saw, you know, actually works. It's a nice moose. I looked across and Tanga, who is about 7 years old, he's the only boy of the group. And again, like I said, the process is we don't touch our food until we bow, and I say it's okay. He's kind of like a typical little kid, kind of like, and he latches onto a cantaloupe, and he picks it up, and I go, Tanga, leave it. He goes, how did that get there? It's not mine. I don't know how that got there, which is really kind of funny, because if you looked on, I've noticed on Facebook, there's been some great little elephant videos on there. I don't know if anybody has seen them. And little elephants with their trunks remind me, it was kind of flashed at me last night. They're like little boys, naked little boys. And they've discovered the appendage that's there. And they you can just see the look of, wow, what is this? We took Tiki up to Bellevue. We were up there for a fundraiser. Keeper and I went up, and we got in real late, and they ended up telling us that we could stay at the old airport. So you know how long ago that was, if you're familiar with Bellevue. There used to be an airfield there. We pulled in. It was kind of rainy, and we're going, this isn't going to work. She doesn't like sitting out in the rain. So we backed the trailer into an old hangar and proceeded to get a flat tire. That needed to be fixed. It's around 12:30, quarter to one in the morning. So we went to the local gas station, and the other keeper is going to handle the tire. So I took Tiki out of the trailer, and we were standing at the service station along this main road as the clubs were letting out that night. And you could see these people, like, you know, I don't know if anybody's done this, but they're, okay, just let me get home. Let me get home. What the hell is that? We sit and watch, and I'd stand here with this elephant, and you see these cars going by, and I go, Tiki, wave. And people would just, like,
he shuffles around.
One actually turned around and came back and said, is that an elephant? And I go, where? We went up, and we did our thing for the fundraiser and loaded her back up in the, well, actually, that night was kind of interesting, is that she didn't sleep well. And then we were loaded up in the trailer, and we're heading back down to the park. She gets in the trailer.
She's
kind of doing this rocking motion. If you've ever tried to drive when something that big is kind of doing this, it's really kind of interesting. And I happened to look in my rearview mirror, and I saw a white VW Rabbit come in right behind us to draft. And I said, well, okay, that's interesting. It's not really safe. Going along, next thing I look in the mirror again, and I see this huge cloud, like a big fog, just rolled in from out of nowhere and completely envelop the white VW Rabbit. Elephants, you have to realize, come from an arid country, and they consolidate their water, and they only use enough to get rid of the toxins, the pee and that sort of stuff. They don't use a whole lot of water, so it's rather thick and viscous. Well, it went all over this rabbit. And next thing, when it did come out of the fog, the windshield wipers were going. There was lots of water being sprayed on there. And again, it's really thick, and it was matted all over the top of the car. He came around alongside of me. And obviously, he was a fan of the zoo, because he reached all the way over to the passenger side and said, you're number one. Thank you for allowing me to tell my story.
This is KTOO News Juneau 104.3 FM. The stories you just heard were recorded on May 13th, 2015. The theme for the evening was Poop, Parasites, and Pests. To tell your story or to find out when you can attend the next live event, visit mudrooms.org. Audio production by Alita Buss, Steve Sewing, and Rich Moniak. I'm Amanda Compton. Have a good night.